The other thing that was interesting about that Trump put day was all of the degens were piling into triple leverage Qs and triple leverage semiconductor ETFs. The leverage 2x long ETFs have shattered their records and flows. So the degen crowd kept buying the dip, even on the way down. And I was like, man, at some point they're going to get tired of this because they're just losing, losing, losing. But then that day, Soxel was up 50%. And my metaphor is you go fishing, you catch a marlin. You are going to go fishing again. So that is only going to re-embolden the gens to keep buying the dip. And it's going to re-embolden the I can't market time Vanguardians to think they can't market time. So that one Trump put day to me says, if you're hoping for some big crash, you might get down days, but I just don't see it given the resolve of these types of investors who use ETFs. They just, both the degens and the Vanguardians seem to be like really into buying the dip, regardless of what they hear or see.
Joining us on the show is Eric Balchunas, the senior ETF analyst at Bloomberg and host of the incredibly popular and authoritative podcast, Trillions, about the meteoric rise of ETFs.
This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term investor. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss macro, markets, investment strategies, and more.
Eric, welcome. It's great to see you and have you back on the show.
Great to be here. Always enjoy it.
I don't know about you, Mike, but I'm really happy to get this chance to talk to Eric. It's such a crazy time. Eric, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm feeling pretty good. Relatively speaking, I know the markets are a bit wild, but I'm just doing my thing, you know, trying to stay in my ETF lane and stay out of trouble for the most part, at least bad trouble. Good trouble's okay. But yeah, we're busy. This is a good time for readership. If you're a writer, This is what I call get while the getting's good. You get way more readership in these like crazy markets. So you got to hustle, dive for all the loose balls, put out as many notes as possible. And these stats tend to help weigh out the boring times.
Yeah, there's an emotional salience, right? Yeah. That there's a heightened emotional sensitivity that investors have. And that's a heightened opportunity for, you know, catalyzing better and longer term learnings. Some of them may or may not be, depending on your tilt at that time, but it really does provide an opportunity for people to dig in. And that's what, in discussion with advisors and clients, you know, there's kind of four things I see out there. One is you make sure your risk is right? Make sure your volatility that you can handle in the long term is matching what's happening in the short term. Make sure you've got some liquidity around. Make sure you're taking advantage of all the opportunities to diversify, asset classes, strategies, and so on. And then finally, make sure you stay on top of things. One of the things that investors tend to do at these times is kind of turtle up or look away. And volatility in the end creates opportunity.
Yeah.
And so you really have to stay engaged. And there's a lot of things happening under the surface. And I know you've got a bunch of gems to talk about today too, Eric, that you guys have sort of pulled away the curtains on, where, you know, headlines aren't matching flows, and, you know, there's a number of items that aren't quite in sync. So maybe you can take us through some of your observations that you've had recently.
Yeah, I mean, just look at the total ETF flows this year, $333 billion. So that puts them on just about a $1 trillion pace. Like, they're basically as good as last year. Well, last year, trillion was a record. And last year was utopia. Like, everything was up, no problems. So the fact they're taking all this money is interesting to me. And U.S. equities or U.S. stock ETFs had a record first quarter. Like, their year over year from right now, whatever, April, mid-April, is a record pace. And a big reason for that is VU. VU is at $50 billion so far. And I have a couple theories on this. One, we kind of call it the Vanguard clip. These Vanguard-type investors are just, they're so married to this premise of just dollar cost averaging. They've given up market timing and they're just like an immovable object. But $50 billion is way more than that. So I think beyond the sort of just I'm not doing anything flows is a rebalance. I think when you have a target date fund or a model and international has a good run and the US is lagging, you might get actually some extra money from rebalancing. So I would say that this is why the market probably isn't down more. If you read the headlines out there and you had no price information and you read the headlines like for the past month, you would say the market's down 30% probably. You'd be like, wow, we're probably like in a depression. The market's probably down 30%. And meanwhile, it's, what is it, down 7-8% year to date? And I know it's had like a drawdown that's a little steeper, but we always speak in calendar year, 7-8% year to date. It could be worse. And I think that Vanguard put is why it's not 12-13. And so I think some of the money that's moving is algos and professionals. I know, our macro strategy team definitely thinks there's probably more opportunity in international for the time being. So I think some institutions might have repositioned over there. So it's interesting, the sort of bifurcation or the disconnect now between the retail flow and the sort of professional slash algo flow. They seem to be a little on the different pages, but that's not that abnormal. Every sell-off, we sort of see this. So we'll see how it goes from here. But I think the other thing to just mention here is that even though U.S. equity did have a great quarter, cash-like ETFs also are crushing it. So I think people are buying beta, but they're buying cash with it to make themselves feel a little better about everything, and a little gold. Gold's having a nice flow a year after getting blown out by Bitcoin last year. Gold's finally starting to get some money. So I think gold and cash are being bought with beta. That might be the one thing you see in the retail flows that's a little bearish.
I really enjoyed your take on the Trump put from your last episode. I thought, for me, like what it did was it actually put things in perspective. And I think we're at a time when advisors and investors alike really need a good footing, a perspective, something to lean on. And the idea that there's an identifiable thing happening, all it takes is a word from the president, pause, right? All it takes is that one word. And everything comes racing back, right?
And we had this meme of like, it's a big wide shot of all these like zombies on the ground. It's like a mass amount of, I think it's from World War Z movie or something. And we say algos anytime someone tweets the word pause in all caps. Like, by the way, that Wednesday when Trump said pause, right? The market went up like, what, 8%? And it went up 8% in like 2 hours. It wasn't like a whole day. It was like right up. And that tells you that the Trump put was there, I think, because one word did it. He, caved, you want to call it, or pivoted. But that did show people, in my opinion, also that if you were somebody who was just vanguarding away, you're probably like, that's why I was vanguarding away, because who the hell knows when this stuff's going to happen. The other thing that was interesting about that Trump put day was all of the degens were piling into triple leverage Qs and triple leverage semiconductor ETFs. The leverage 2x long ETFs have shattered their records and flows. So the degen crowd kept buying the dip, even on the way down. And I was like, man, at some point they're going to get tired of this because they're just losing. But then that day, Soxel was up 50%. And, my metaphor is you go fishing, you catch a marlin. You are going to go fishing again. So that is only going to re-embolden the gens to keep buying the dip. And it's going to re-embolden the I can't market time Vanguardians to think they can't market time. So that one Trump put day to me says, if you're hoping for some big crash, I mean, you might get down days, but I just don't see it given the resolve of these types of investors who use ETFs. They just, both the degens and the Vanguardians seem to be like really into buying the dip, regardless of what they hear or see.
Yeah. I mean, those are, the word I was thinking of is guardrails. When you're a kid and you go bowling and there's guardrails in the gutters, if you wait long enough, like if things are getting bad enough, they're going to call it.
And yeah. The other thing is,
but that's something, I think that's an idea that you can almost lean on. It's not that it's you know, 100% reliable or it's quantifiable. We don't know when you know, the words are going to hit the press. It's something that you can actually count on, like detente, you know, mutual assured destruction not happening.
Yeah.
As bad as it is.
If in a weird way, you know, and I know if Mike Green were on here, he would disagree, but the Vanguardians have been somewhat of a stabilizing force. They do have that persistent bid. It doesn't stop the market from going down, but it probably adds a floor. The other thing that's, I think, hard to shake is this love of U.S. stocks. Because if you anecdotally talk to people, they just don't want to trade in Apple, Amazon, Walmart, Costco for like Nestle and a bunch of European names they never heard of. And I think the image of Europe is like 30 hours a week, work week, not much innovation, no tech. And I'm not sure all that's fair, but so I do think the love of the growth in America and the stock market here is still there. I think a lot of people have, whether they can articulate it or not, do think what we think, in that to a degree, the S&P 500 is more powerful than any president. Maybe not short term sometimes, but long term, you can just see, put who the president is, it just blows through anything. Democrat, Republican, you know, Desert Gulf War. I mean, it just seems to be that you're not investing in politics, really. That's an element, but you're investing in these companies. These people get up every day, innovate, work their butts off, and that's what you're buying. And I don't know if that's gone. I know that if there's massive tariffs, that gets like, it's a little like sand in the engine, but it's still there. Like, nobody's like not going to do that. So I think until there's like real recessionary stuff on the streets, or a year or two of this where internationals just being the U.S. for like 12 to 24 months, I just don't see anybody really doing much who's let's say a non-trader.
I think gold is a pretty good example of something that's been, you know, performing as well as U.S. stocks for the last number of years. And, you know, obviously since sort of February, significantly outperforming U.S. stocks. But it takes time, right? You were just talking about the flows finally turning sort of positive for gold this year in the ETF space in the U.S., where the price has been up pretty substantially over the last year. So it's finally caught on. Gold is a diversifying asset class in the U.S., it would seem.
Yeah,
and I guess the thesis is sort of the same. Sure, you know, EFA so far this year is substantially outperforming U.S. markets, but how durable is that, you know, given all of the things you pointed out? And I suppose it's, you know, markets at different prices too. You know, the S&P and NASDAQ did get quite expensive back in 2000, comparatively speaking, and it led to a, you know, 10 or 15 year underperformance, which did lead to the BRICS and all those things. So you lay out a path that's pretty compelling. So what do you think the catalyst is then? Is it this just the one-time rebalancing? Folks are saying, okay, well, there is some risk in the U.S. markets and trading the U.S. markets, and there's a valuation gap, so we're doing a little bit of rebalancing at the moment. Is that what's going on, basically?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think it's just at the edges. I will say European ETFs do have $7 billion in flows this year. That's pretty good for a category that has $40 billion in assets, right? That's a pretty good percentage uptick. But that number was like one or two until like a couple of weeks ago. So it finally, you know, here's the thing. I always say people have seen this movie before, but it's really more like a short film. Europe has this like good quarter, even 5-6 months. And people are like, I'm not biting on that. It's like a fish that just knows its bait. But, you know, now we're in April, some flows coming in, and the flows will help drive up prices. So, you know, I think you see a couple more months of this, you could see some real movement. But I think for the most part, people are still committed to the U.S., doing a little rebalancing. Gold is $7 billion too. So gold and Europe are taking the same out. And gold had struck out last year. It was up a lot, but it took in nothing. I think Bitcoin stole its thunder a little bit. I think Bitcoin's sort of like the young, I call it teenager gold. It's sort of like the... And well, last year, people craved hot sauce more than protection anyway. So Bitcoin plays that hot sauce role. So people bought into Bitcoin. It was new. It was returning great. And gold was good, but Bitcoin was great. Now, this year, gold, in my opinion, got a big W. I mean, it really worked. It has hedged your portfolio. I told the Bitcoiners, you got to just tip your hat sometimes. Like, you know, I know Peter Schiff is out there spiking the football every other day. But in the way he earned it, that said, if you zoom out even a little bit, I mean, Bitcoin's still way above. So my metaphor here is it's like Ohio State, Michigan. You know how Michigan has just started winning? That's like gold, you know, but Ohio State is like won like 16 of the last 20, and that's Bitcoin. So I think this rivalry between these two is really fascinating. It reminds me of the football rivalry in that it's just like, it's a true contempt there. I mean, it's just like just honest to God hatred, even though they have a lot in common. They both want to hedge inflation. They think governments are not trustworthy. Like they're actually way more aligned, but I think they're competing for the same type of audience. So they are very competitive and it's fun to watch, interesting to watch. But I would say gold is having the better year. Although we wrote today about how Bitcoin was arguably more stable. Just the fact that it's above 80,000, I think, is remarkable to me because it was at 30 when the ETFs came out less than 2 years ago. So the fact that it was able to go up and stay up there after all this, it's kind of gone down like beta. It hasn't gone down maybe a touch of high beta, but it's not like the Q's on steroids anymore where it goes down 50% when the Q's goes down 25%. And I think our theory is that it has better owners because over the last 20 months, all these like governments that confiscated Bitcoin, FTX lawsuits, GBTC captives, these were bad owners. They dumped all their Bitcoin and bought it, the ETFs and Michael Saylor. These are good owners. These are way less fickle people and less retailish. And I think the ETF money is largely smart advisors, retail, those types who understand behavior. And so I just think you're, and we've actually seen the volatility, it's stabilized since the ETFs came about. It's still 70% 90 day, but the volatility is flatlined. It's just solid 70. But back in the day, it could get up to 150. The other thing is the correlation to the stocks is actually creeped down a little too. So it's a decoupled a touch. I still wouldn't, if I'm selling a Bitcoin ETF, I'm not telling some retiree or someone like Boomer, I'm not saying this will hedge the stock market. I'm going to tell them this is like hot sauce. It still behaves like a risk asset. If it doesn't, consider yourself lucky, but don't expect that. But it is, in my opinion, a hedge against the global money printer long term. But it's still too young. Gold's 4,000 years old and behaves like a true alt. I just don't think Bitcoin's in that category yet.
Yeah, it's still a little bit innovative. It's still too innovative and is going to suffer both the benefits and the drawbacks of being such an innovative, cutting edge technology. And hey, we're like you. We believe in the same thing. BTGD is like you can stack Bitcoin and gold in one ETF and get 100% of each. That's why you don't have to choose, people.
It is interesting.
You do not have to choose.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Be the uniting force on that. You can be hot sauce and put some hot sauce right on your gold bar. Anyway,
it's true. I mean, they honestly, if your goal is to hedge the global money printer, that's a good. It makes sense to have both, in my opinion. I can appreciate what both do. They're
and you touch on a great point on the owners. You know, there's a lot of the diamond hands and a lot of lingo that's slightly different in the crypto world. But the owners are pretty long-term, if you will. And even as we expand that ownership into, you know, the traditional finance space, you saw Fidelity launch a bunch of global ETFs, the all-in-one type stuff, where they included a 1-3% position in Bitcoin. Right. Yeah. So here you have responsible allocation by pretty major, well, by the most major financial shops in the world, and they're taking a prudent approach. So that ends up being a little bit more longer term money. It ends up being a little bit more stable and able to be held through drawdowns and in fact added to during drawdowns, and a rebalancing tailwind that happens because you have, you know, 1-3% position in a 70 vol asset. you know, that's going to be 6% at some point along the way. And it's also going to be 1.5% along the way, yep, which provides great opportunities for just like a simple dumb rebalancing on an annual basis. So, you know, I think there's something there. I also think that's evolving, right? So you see this sailor purchases and the inevitable washing of volatility down the track for another items. So the asset is becoming financialized, right? And to think it's not, is that's where I think when I talk with sort of a Bitcoin audience or a crypto audience, sometimes they miss that. I'm trying to bring them, you know, listen, you have futures that trade this. Once you have futures that trade this, there's a cascade of offsets of risk of people who are going to be short because of something they're doing. And those shorts are buyers at lower prices. And that institutional framework didn't exist, you know, if you go back to 2017 or 2015 in the history. Also on the upside, right, you're going to have structures in place where, you know, you got the options market, you got the futures market, now you've got solid ETFs. You're going to have options on ETFs, I imagine, at some point too. So all of these things tend to have some, you know, different consequence. Assets get financialized. So once an asset has some financialization to it, it's got hot sauce in a significant drawdown, it's interesting what can happen. Sometimes so, very good, sometimes
these it feels like Fidelity 1-3%. This isn't their whole nest egg, so it's you can have a little more of the intestinal fortitude because it's precisely not the main thing. Whereas some of the young people who bought it back in the FTX days, I think, you know, they got spooked. They also were buying it through FTX and these other exchanges, which have high commissions. So the device in which they were getting it was also a little ripoffy. And the ETFs are so cheap, so liquid. They got the brand names, like you got Larry Fink saying it's okay. I think that those investors are just a little more happy with the whole setup. You know, how I get it, who I get it with, the fee I'm paying, I'm fine. I'm not going to move. So the ETFs, I think, have gone a long way. I go to these crypto conferences. I get invited to speak at these Bitcoin conferences, and I like it because it's a new audience, and they get a lot of people. I mean, some of these rooms are 300-400 people, and I basically tell them ETFs are more punk rock than you think. They're as just as disruptive as your Bitcoin. They are a powerful vehicle, and the marriage is pretty interesting. And so I sort of go over why I think the ETFs have been so, you know, good for Bitcoin and vice versa. I think a lot of these issuers are happy to put out products where Vanguard doesn't exist, you know.
Well, let's talk. Can you dig into that? What you're seeing, some of the challenges on the different coins that have faced regulatory scrutiny? Because there's a number of items there that are neat to dig into.
It's interesting to see the S&P 500 is more volatile than Bitcoin.
Yeah, they love that because it's, let's face it, this is a blip. S&P would typically be 15%, Bitcoin 75%, but the tantrum made the S&P 75%, at least on a 10-day vol basis. Yeah. Crazy.
Well, it was a bit, I did find a few of the memes entertaining where the crypto is throwing memes at the S&P. Say, oh my god, oh gosh, a 9% drawdown, oh you poor thing. I know. That's sort of pretty. Well, I'm like, okay, guys do have some scars.
And I have some a lot of crypto followers now, and what I find is they remind me of Veruca Salt from Willy Wonka. You know, she's like spoiled, and they're like how come it's down today? And I'm like, dude, you're up like 150% rolling 12 months. Like,
yeah,
Jesus Christ. Like, their mood is dictated by the price intra hour. Like, it did. I was like, you got to touch grass. You know, you got to get out a little bit. I tell them, don't even look at intraday. Just look at a rolling 12 month or rolling 3 year. And just look at if that percentage goes from 150 to 149. Okay, fine. That's going to make you less depressed than it went down 3% today. And because early on, they started to blame the ETFs. I'm like, whoa, you guys should be thanking Larry Fink. I hate to say it. They're like, oh, I would never thank TradFi, you know. The idea that Larry Fink has come in, biggest asset manager. I mean, he is TradFi, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting to see their internal spiritual tension between, you know, oh my God, we're selling out to TradFi, Larry Fink's going to own all the Bitcoin versus, well, but number goes up.
Well, here's the funny thing, right?
Like,
how do you think if this asset class is going to get to $1 million price tag, how the fuck do you think it's going to get there without TradFi money?
Yeah.
Excuse my French. You have to sell. Like, yeah, if it's going to get $1 million market a tag, it's because TradFi has fully adopted and accepted this as some other sort of gold type asset, a digital gold type asset, or some other thesis has come into play where it has been broadly accepted by the trillions of dollars that are available for investment globally. So you have to, and I agree, this cognitive dissonance of, oh my God, we don't want to sell to TradFi. Well, did you want number go up or did you not want number go up?
Yeah, and I think for the most part, they all kind of are accepting it. And I also explained to them that Larry Fink doesn't own them. I mean, he's just storing
Correct.
For people who yes. want to outsource this hassle. It's not similar to the exchanges. You know, if you bought Bitcoin on Coinbase, it's not your wallet, really. I mean, they're...
Well, this is where you get into the no keys, no, not your keys, not yeah. your coins argument.
Right. That's why people who are okay with crypto exchanges, I think, are like, oh yeah, the ETF's just basically competing with the exchanges. It's just the outsourced way to buy Bitcoin. And if you think of it as like 10 million investors versus Larry Fink owning it, it also calms you down. This is what sometimes Bernie Sanders will tweet out like, oh my God, BlackRock's the biggest owner of like all the companies. But I'm like, well, it's actually 30 million people who BlackRock just stewards the money for. So I think
how successful have you been at correcting that narrative? Because that is something that's pervasive. Two companies in the world own all the stocks in the world. And I'm like, I'm just kind of, I want to take it. That's not the way it's working. They do have some influence with voting the shares to some degree, but it's not like they own the shares.
The TikTok investors person, great follow, by the way, they'll throw something that's on TikTok about some guy who's like, look, dude, look at all the BlackRock and Vanguard own the whole thing, that they're colluding, and they get the conspiracy guy. And when it gets thrown on Twitter, the dunking is rampant. So I think everybody knows. So you might get some random guy on TikTok who's like, this is crazy. Because if you look at it, I could see the point of going, wait a second, two companies own everything? And it's like, first of all, they own 15% of every company. It's not like they own 100%. And second of all, they are stewards for real. I think it's like 60, 70 million investors between them. Anyway, most people...
They're the trustee and the custodian in a highly regulated world.
Yeah.
Holding assets on behalf of others, just like we do in pension funds, just like we do in your stock account, just like we do in finance.
Bernie Sanders tweets that out once a year. I think it's around Thanksgiving for some reason. The same tweet about the three, he puts the three of them. I think it's the big two, includes State Street.
Yeah.
And I know he knows.
Right.
But I think sometimes people are like, I get it, but I need the political points.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, if you want to get people's attention, you have to paint it in a fantastic way, right?
Yeah.
People will fall asleep.
If you say that thing that came out from Sanford Bernstein that said, the passive is worse than Marxism.
Yeah.
And I thought, damn, I don't agree, but that is a great title. I got it. You're going to get clicks, man. You're going to get yours. Talking about getting while the getting's good. That's a home run title. Anyway, I remember speaking with Bogle in one of the last interviews I had with him. This is how hardcore he was. He was 88 years old, so he's a year away from dying at this point. And this guy from Chicago puts a piece out saying that the passive is bad for owning stocks because if you own all the sectors, you're incentivized to have prices go up. So they could, like a cartel, let's all raise the prices of all the airlines since Vanguard owns this. They're like, everybody raise your prices, we'll get more money for the index investors. That was his take. And it's phrased in a way that when the headline comes out, it gets a lot of clicks because it's like, oh, something's like going on. Well, he told me, A, he does worry about those because if New York Times writes about it and then Elizabeth Warren reads it, she's going to think she can run on it. The second thing he did that was fascinating was 6 months before he passed away, he went to Princeton, called in the author of that study, Eric Posner of University of Chicago. He called in Cliff Asness. He called in Gus Sauter, Andrew Lowe of MIT, Bert Malkiel. There's a couple others. It was basically a roundtable of the greatest thinkers in the funds world, so to speak. And he had Eric there, and they just sat there for 3 hours and just debated this topic. And that was 6 months before he passed away. And I just thought, man, that is the amount of passion there to do that late in life and think and still care. And you can watch it on TV, on Princeton's site. They have that video. It's kind of interesting to watch. But he wanted to snuff this out. He wanted to give the people their voice. You don't want to say, you suck. So give them a voice, hear from us. And as you watch this, you realize Eric Posner wasn't standing on a whole lot. I mean, Gus Sauter was there too. And he's like, I've been doing the voting for Vanguard. And like, I never think about this. I'm just trying to say, like, you know, what's best for the actual company. I'm not colluding. I've never spoken to the BlackRock people. So there's a lot of like stuff that came out in that meeting that like, I don't think the people who write these things actually talk to the people. I think they write them in a vacuum and make, you know, sort of throw from the cheap seats this bomb. And Bogle's like, why don't we talk about it? And then anyway, so I think a lot of times once you sort of play it out, you're like, it's fine. Now the companies have started to allow you to vote. So if you want to vote your shares now, there's these programs that you can vote them. But who in the hell wants to read all those proxies? Like 90% of them are boring. There's a couple interesting ones. I think what they should do is you can give it to a proxy company. Like if you lean left, give it to the ESG company. If you lean right or middle, let them just do your voting. I think that's cool. Or poll your investors, find out where they stand, and then vote based on the polling. So there's solutions there in process to try to, because it is true that Larry Fink does have a 9% vote in every company. And that's why when he said, I want to clean up the environment, I want to do ESG, everybody flipped out. Because it's like, okay, who cares if he puts ESG ETFs out? That's not a big deal. But you own 9% of every corporation. This is not right, because not all your investors feel the same way. And that's when you had all the blowback with Strive, and he's since pivoted away. But that was a whole thing for a while.
Yeah. And I think that is the probably the heart of the issue, really, is that type of situation where, you know, you're going to put your thumb on the scale of corporations based on your views, and as whether you agree with them or not, that's kind of not the point. It's, you know, it's your money, it should be your views, not Larry's.
You can never win though, because even Bogle would slam Vanguard in his books for not voting enough to limit the pay of the CEOs. He hated that, and he's slamming his own company, and so he was pissed at his own company. And then I talk to people and they're like, we get it worse from the left, but we also get it from the right. And so they're just like, they can make nobody happy in that position.
Oh, God, yeah.
And here they are just trying to offer like near dirt cheap fees. And I kind of feel for them a little bit. It's an impossible position. So I get why they're like, hey, okay, you vote, man. Here's all the documents. Go ahead, knock yourself out.
No good deed goes unpunished, bro.
It's true.
There's always a yang somewhere.
If you try to please everyone, you please no one.
Yep.
Yeah.
So maybe let's look at that. That was awesome. Let's circle back though. I do want to talk about the crypto, just those different types of crypto assets. Cause I think, again, these are things that are a little bit under the surface. Not everybody knows. And I think you've got some value to add there on, you know, you've been quite vocal on how you're seeing this crypto ETF market roll out, some of the challenges some coins have had versus others and why. I think that would be a value to the listeners as well. And then what you think is the rollout coming for traditional finance on various coins.
Sure. So I would just look at it like commodities. You know, gold has 80% of the share. Silver has 10. Platinum and palladium have 5 each. And then the futures commodities have their own little wing, but it's pretty small compared to the precious metals. It's going to be like that. I think the further you get away from Bitcoin, the less assets there will be. So spot Bitcoin to me is going to rule the world in that category for a long time. I don't see anything changing that. Ethereum did okay. In a normal launch, it would have been successful, but it came after Bitcoin. So my metaphor was, it's like like the opening act having to follow the headliner. It was just in a doomed position, even though it did pretty well. Ether also had terrible performance, whereas Bitcoin had good performance. So timing can help, you know, if you launch and your stuff goes up, it's easier. So Ether kind of just had a, like I said, it was like trying to follow Hendrix or something. Like you know, and you're like a band with like one hit song. It's like, it's just impossible position. So Ether will exist, but it'll just never, it'll always live in the shadow of Bitcoin. And then you've got the new kids on the block coming, which is like Solana, XRP. They have futures-based versions of those out. The spot one's not approved yet, but the futures ones have been okay. The XRP one has been a little better. Solana, a little less, but these are not the best guinea pigs, but they're all the only guinea pigs we have. But it tells me that like if you issue spot Solana XRP, you're going to have like a couple billion. You're not going to set the world on fire here. And then you've got the sort of, then we get into silly season. There's going to be a Trump ETF, a Melania ETF. There's going to be a 2x Melania ETF, Doge. And then there's stuff I never heard of, like SUI. There's a Bonk. I you know, I got to Google every third filing now. No, it's serious. I'm like, what even is that? So there's a lot of stuff coming out now. Every now and then, one of the commodities catches fire, like coffee. There's a, you know, So Joe, the coffee ETF gets some looks for a year. That's what's going to happen. Like, let's say the Bonk ETF goes wild. You know, it'll be a flavor of the month for a minute, and then it will die down. That's how I see all of this playing out. So, and the crazy stuff will get media attention, but it won't get much assets. The same thing we see with the theme ETF. Some of these themes get crazy, but most of the money is in like natural resources and infrastructure, the boring stuff. Like, but you know, we in the media, we're always, you know, looking for good copy. So I think we're going to cover this a lot. And anything new is interesting. I mean, this is a whole category of crypto that was opened by the Bitcoin, and we'll, you know, it's like a Pandora's box that's just opening, and it's so new that we will definitely cover it a lot. But I would look for the boring spot Bitcoin ETF to continue to dominate by far.
And where are you seeing the fees come out on these more esoteric versions that are in the pipe? Are they still razor thin like the Bitcoin ones, or are they a little bit wider?
So they're about the same on Ether, but the XRP ones that came out are really high. But one's leverage, one does futures. Once the, like, we'll call it like the horse race. You know, when 9 or 10 of them launched at once, they actually all had a fee war, and it brought their fees down to like 20 basis points. Same thing happened with Ether. But with the XRP, there's been these fluky one-offs, and they charge like 1%. So the, what will happen is when spot Solana and spot XRP come out, BlackRock isn't in that, but I think Fidelity is. I don't see them going to 20 just yet, but they might be 30, 40. But you have to understand, the other reason that the US spot Bitcoin ETFs are so powerful is that 20 basis points for what they do, plus super liquidity, right? The spread is always one basis point. Compare that to what was out there. GBTC was 2%. European Bitcoin ETFs were 1% to 2%. Hedge funds are 1% to 2%. So it was literally like, you know, 5 to 10 times cheaper with super liquidity, with brand names. And if you look at any advisor survey of what matters, you know, it's brand, fee, liquidity. Like, those are important. And they had really strong showings on those. So the more that these coins are launched in the ETFs, especially under this spot in the 33x spot product, like a GLD, it will help those coins generally, because the low cost liquidity and brand names are very powerful. Even if you put dog shit, you know, if you have a liquid ETF that's cheap and holds like dog manure, I mean, it's possible to get some looks just because that's such a good deal. You know, there was a study that showed people who have Amazon buy twice as much shit than they do when, if you take the app away, simply because it's so easy.
Yeah.
So you add friction, or you take away all that friction, cost, your wallets, all that, and you just say, you click a button, you own this thing. It's so powerful for that underlying asset. The problem for the other coins is it's just the audience shrinks every time you get to a new coin. So it's like...
Right, yeah. But, and just look at the work Bitcoin's had to do over the last 15 years to get to where it is.
Yeah.
That's a lot of trials and tribulations, and anything else that's going to be rising through, matriculating through the scale process is going to have to do the same sort of thing.
You know, and this really made me think, you know, what else has gone through 70% drawdowns like three times? Right?
It's true.
And come back. This is where it differs from Beanie Babies and like Don Mattingly Rookie Cards, is that those things go down, they're just gone. This has survived like three or four of them. And someone pointed out, you know what else has? Apple, Amazon, Google. These stud Mag 7 companies, most of them have survived these sort of near-death experiences multiple times.
Yep.
And that's powerful, in my opinion. Even if at the end of the day, I'm Boglian in the fact that there are no cash flows, it's only worth what someone else will pay. It's like a commodity. You have to acknowledge that. What I don't think the crypto people understand is that they don't understand that stocks have cash flows, and you get your money works for you. You are an owner of the company. People get up, create value, and you get a piece of that value. They think it's just something that just trades like on a casino, just like Bitcoin. They don't understand the intrinsic value or the investment return. Yep. They just think it's all speculative. And I think that's where the crypto people are a little screwy. But the TradFi, I think, underrate Bitcoin for its survivability and some other things. I think the crypto people underrate stocks and bonds to a degree, although bonds haven't been great for 10 years, but stocks in particular, I don't know if they understand how it's different than a commodity.
Yeah. I also think that you know, from a generational perspective, what kind of investors are we raising, right? When you think about the number of people who are involved in the crypto space and their average age, and you know, the thing that really kind of stuck with me as being a wow moment was, you know, that Piper Jaffray study they do every year where they poll the sort of the 12 to 22 year olds. Like I'm probably getting the average dates wrong, but it's like the young generation.
What do they find?
Yeah. So what they pull them for is, what are you buying? What's neat? What's cool? Right. What are the brands that what are you enthused about? What are the, you know, so it's things like everything from makeup to running shoes to video games, but also, are you investing and do you own crypto? And something like 15 or 20% of this cohort owned some sort of digital currency. You know, two things. One, they didn't get it from their parents. Like, you categorically know that of only a vanishingly small group of crypto-headed dads and moms gave their kids crypto. And TradFi, nobody gave them crypto.
Yeah.
So what that leads you to is the second conclusion is they went and got it themselves.
Yeah.
And they're 20 years of age, 20, 22 or younger. They didn't go buy the S&P. They didn't buy Apple. They didn't buy Amazon. They got cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
And then now we have this very young cohort who is involved long before they've ever been involved in any kind of stock paradigm.
Yeah.
In a general sense. And then all of the things that you just talk about, the speculative nature of it, the sort of the chasing of this, and what's the value and how do you discern value? And their whole framework for that is we're breeding a totally different group of investors in that space. And I have no idea what the implications are.
Yeah.
Well, they know the price. They don't know the value, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe we don't know the value. Like, I don't know. Don't know. Like, these are the
future. What are the fundamentals, right?
Yeah. Maybe we're missing the point. I don't know.
Yeah. No, and I just think you have to acknowledge what the young people are doing, what they care about. But I know, like, my kid had the stock picking class, and the whole goal is who can pick 5 stocks, do better in 3 months.
Well, isn't that the worst? That's the worst thing ever. The worst program ever.
Yeah. So the whole educational system is one issue. The second is young people like to have their own thing. For me, it was like cool bands and stuff like that. It's different now. I think it's more like they like that. It's Apple's like a boomer stock or something. So I get that. I do think also young people, as they get more domesticated, you know, get married, have a mortgage, they'll move over to more 401k-ish money. I do think like a lot of the crypto bros are single, so they can be all in. So I do think some of that will change over time. But once you get into something young, it's really powerful because you're just comfortable with it. And that's why I really respect it and I don't dismiss it. And, but I can't get away from the fact that ultimately it's a commodity. I mean, that's the, I just think that it is like something that,
and it has, you know, it has some guy carefully, called, right?
This guy that, I like to follow, he's more of a retail investor, but he's into crypto, but he's just good at explaining things sometimes. He called crypto or Bitcoin, the Second Amendment of money, which is that it is protection from your own government debasing your currency because they can't F with the Bitcoin. And because it was sort of modeled off of Cold War technology of a decentralized system that couldn't be nuked, it's nuke proof. I mean, government can't really, even if you're trying to shut it down, it's nice having something that is government proof. That is powerful also, in my opinion, but that still doesn't change the fact that it's a commodity and doesn't have cash flow. So that's why I like both for me, but some people, there's camps, you know?
Yep. All right. So we've actually done lots of talk on crypto. It's not really a crypto podcast, but I think we've bridged the gap from TradFi to crypto. Anything? What else have you got? What else are you looking at on the docket that is? We talked a little bit. Have we talked about the headlines and the differences that you're seeing? And I don't think we actually dug into the.
No,
we did the Vanguard put.
The only thing I wanted to mention that was more of an industry issue was that this year you're going to see like upwards of 50 mutual fund companies just bolt on an ETF share class to their mutual fund. This is big. Right. If it were for the market this year, this story would be a lot higher on what's going on. It was all the talk at the last ETF conference, and 50, I think it's 55 or something, and represents like over 10 trillion in assets. So all of these legacy fund companies with these huge active funds, instead of converting to an ETF or launching a clone, they want to just put an ETF share class a la the Vanguard model. And it's going to be crazy. It's going to get wild. But we wrote a note saying that the only issue is that Vanguard's model was not the best guinea pig because they largely see inflows. So when you see inflows into the mutual fund, it's easy to use the ETF to do tax management, and people can then switch to the ETF, and it's just great. But outflows are not, we haven't really seen this experiment where the fund sees mostly outflows. So I found one Vanguard ETF, EDV, which saw a big third of the fund was redeemed in 2009, probably because of 2008, right? And the ETF, so the mutual fund saw the big redemption. The ETF had a 14% capital gains distribution. Massive. Well, like short-term capital gains. That, we call it tax contagion, and that's the one thing to watch out for here. Otherwise, I think it's pretty net positive, and I think what happened, a lot of people will switch from the mutual fund class into the ETF class because they can without tax consequence. The question is, if people just leave the mutual fund, how does the ETF pay for those sins at all with the taxes? Anyway, this is something that is going to be approved probably in the next month or two. And by the end of the summer, I think we're going to start to see launches of share classes and mutual funds. And so get ready.
So that's just going to make launches. What mutual fund survives in that circumstance?
It's like, you know, when I did this at our big event in December, I showed a picture of There Will Be Blood. You know, when Daniel Plainview is speaking to Eli and he's like, I drink your milkshake. He's like, drainage. I just feel like the ETF is essentially going to drain the oil from under the mutual fund. But it will take a while. So I don't know. But the alternative is the mutual fund is like, hey, I got to get in the ETF game. That's what the advisors want. And this might be a way for me to actually limit capital gains in my mutual fund classes. So I can use the ETF like a dialysis machine to wash out capital gains. So that's the mutual fund's point of view. How does this help flows go into mutual funds? It doesn't. But it helps the mutual fund company, I think, possibly adapt to the new world and not lose more investors.
Yeah, I mean, they're at a competitive disadvantage when it comes to, ETFs versus mutual funds holding the same
underlying. And there's some popular, legit popular mutual funds. It's not all death and destruction, but largely speaking, there's outflows literally every week, every month, like clockwork. But they have it because the market's been up so much over 10 years. They have plenty. If they still have like 2 times the assets the ETFs have. And they're doing fine. There's plenty of revenue, but over 10 years time, this is going to be a large transition, to this format.
So. And to be fair, there are lots of times when a mutual fund is better than an ETF. I mean, you trade one price at the end of the day, you get NAV, you don't get slippage, you don't get bad fills.
The problem with that argument is sometimes even if, because you may be saying it as somebody who's run a really good fund, but I think a lot of investors over like 30 years have been in like maybe mediocre funds that charge a lot, ended up disappointing them, and they attach that to the mutual fund.
Yeah.
And so it gets this like negative, a good example is the comp CDs. Remember you'd buy a CD for $16 and it would have like 4 good songs. Well, some bands put out 16 good songs on that motherfucker, right? That was like, so not all CDs were bad. Those 16 good songs were worth $16, but there was enough crapola being sold for $15 that people were like so ready for Napster when it came out.
Yeah.
Screw that. And same thing here. There's definitely good managers who use good mutual funds, but there's enough mediocrity that it's kind of overshadowed a lot of it. That's the issue.
Yep. Yeah, without doubt, and it becomes the advisor or allocator makes the default that I just want ETFs. They do have their challenges, but there are on all the monster liquid stuff, it's great. On some stuff that's a little bit more esoteric,
way better. So I think fund mutual funds are in a better shape and will last longer than equity mutual funds. So up to 20, 30 years from now.
Yeah. And go ahead.
I was just going to say, what are your thoughts on the active ETF market versus passive? What's happening there? I know you had a comment about the Spiva report and.
Yeah. So the Spiva report was interesting. In other countries, like the prices on the active mutual funds are so high, it's almost impossible to outperform. Like the active manager has just weighed themselves down too far. And so the beat rates are really crappy. US beat rates are getting better. Why? Because they're lowering their fees slowly and slowly. And a lot of the crapola funds close. So there's definitely good managers. And then they're using the ETF format now. So Capital Group, Fidelity, a lot of these funds have come into the ETF world priced at around 40 or less. And advisors, I think, are more open to it if it's like, I call it beta adjustment. So like if you're like a 90s mutual fund, you have a lot of beta and you have an ETF, well, don't charge me for the beta, just charge me for the active. And so we find that like the ones that only charge you for the active share seem to feel like a better deal to the advisor and they sell. DFA is a good example, low active share, but low fee. ARK, hot active share, high fee. Thematic ETF, same boat, high active share, high fee. JEPI, which is that options, that's middle of the road, medium active share, medium fee. And so I feel like because beta is free, that's everyone has to adjust to that. And the people who adjust seem to do well. That's traditional. The other part of the active renaissance is that a lot of this active ETFs are buffers, single stock leverage. So there's some whacked out stuff in there that's not like traditional active. Traditional active might be 1/3 or maybe a half, something like that. The other half's the, we'll call it options-based strategies. The traditional stock and bond pickers are half or less of that active renaissance. But well, the ones that have worked seem to be big companies who have somewhat beta adjusted their fees, or a JEPI, which has discovered this popular thing for the moment, you know, where, oh, we'll give you more income on your active. You know, ARK had its moment, you know, these, I'll call them flavor of the years or whatever. Those have popularity too, but DFA, Avantis Capital Group, JP Morgan, there's been several examples of like some legit organic flows into active. And so last year they took in 25% of the flows, but they're now 90% of the launches. So like there's almost no more passive things being launched at all. It's interesting.
Well, what would be the business
competitive field?
Yeah, what would be the business case? So I'll another one.
Like we have Bloomberg has an index business, and like First Trust just did a nuclear theme ETF. That's one you could go active or passive. In this case, they chose to do an index, and that's one example. But it's more niche stuff. But then some company just came out with like BlackRock is going to do S&P 500 minus S&P 100, and I believe that's index. So there is some, you know, there are some indexes still there that seem to come out in the filings, but the vast majority now is active. Because all the leverage people do are do active now, so they can like make sure they don't get burned on when they rebalance. Like active just gives everyone more flexibility from screwing up on the leverage front. And then the buffer ETFs also active because they got to move these options around. But are those really active? I mean, so, but then
form of
we also have just this like, you know, somewhat boring onslaught of like Prudential's ultra short-term bond ETF active. You know, Fidelity's doing this one, and a lot of it's sort of based on a manager they have in their mutual fund they want to have an ETF for. And that is sort of, again, part of the transition to ETFs. And those are more traditional, less exciting. They get less press because they're just sound so, you know, like been there, done that. But I look up sometimes and like, I'm like, wow, the T. Rowe Price such and such has 2 billion. Wow. You know, some of that could be, you know, BYOA, you know, money coming over from the mutual fund. But either way, some of these are getting big, actually. Franklin is now, I think Franklin has like a bunch of funds that are over 1 billion. So you forget how big these mutual fund companies are, by the way. Like Federated, Franklin, like they have, like a lot of them have over 500 billion in assets, if not over a trillion. It's great. So like a lot of them are in the hundreds of billions that you're like, wow. I thought they were, you, in your mind, you're like 30 billion, but they're like 300.
Yeah. Amazing.
Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I'm just wondering we're encroaching on an hour here, but I'm wondering about potentially, I don't want to forget about the, talking about the launch of the private credit ETFs and bringing that sort of private credit to the ETF world and some of your thoughts on that. And there's been no shortage of coverage on those ETFs that are coming down the track.
Let me look up the assets. So private,
that was what I was going to ask the same question, but in a different way. Well, what are some of the long-term novelty or alternative assets that are coming to market?
So the Spider Apollo private credit ETF, Apollo's involvement was huge. Number one, number two, by bringing in Apollo, they were able to get around this 15% illiquidity rule. That was major. It's like they cracked the code on how to get more illiquid. That's going to open the door to a lot of experimentation. So the Spider product isn't necessarily a monster hit. It's got 50 million, but it's representative of what you can maybe do and what you can put in an ETF. So people are going to build on that. The equity one is actually even more interesting. XOVR is this public-private crossover equity. It was a no-name ETF for like 3 years. Guy had nothing going on. Nobody cared. And he switched to public-privates, added SpaceX, and bam, the flows just came hot and heavy. And now he's got like, what was it, 350 million in only like 2 months. A no-name fund. And that told me there was unmet demand for this. And what's interesting is Cathie Wood, at the height of her Cathie Woodness, put out a venture interval fund.
Yeah.
Which is the correct packaging for this. Has like 100, has way less assets. And it's been out for years. And it has all privates. That's crazy to me that you could get all privates plus SpaceX is in there, plus all these other cool private companies, and like no one wants it in that wrapper. Yet you put one of those in an ETF, 10% of the fund is SpaceX, and bam, the people come. So I think one thing, the spider was bonds also, that's kind of less exciting, less boring. So what's interesting to me about the equity side is it's a little more sexy. If they can put in more than 10%, like if they can start adding other companies like besides SpaceX and get to 30, 40, man, I mean, you could have a real frenzy. The Interval Fund is arguably the better wrapper, and all these experts tell me so, and I agree. But when you download, it's like we said earlier, I think they get lumped in with mutual funds. And I just think the interest and trust over on the ETF side is so powerful that I don't care what it is, people want it in there. And I think that price deviating from the NAV, the discount or the premium you see, I think people don't care. They're like, if it's 2% discount, I trust the ETF. You know, yeah. The NAV's probably wrong. And so in these big sell-offs, like these bond ETFs can trade at pretty steep discounts and they still go on afterwards. Like, you know, nobody cares. So I think that if you have liquid in there when it trades like a semi-closed-end fund sometimes, I think people would rather have a hybrid closed-end fund ETF than an actual interval fund when it comes to privates. That's my theory. You could say it's wrong. It doesn't matter. The industry is going to keep pushing that envelope. And I XOVR tells me there's going to be demand for it. The credit side is a little harder to catch just because it's so new still, and bonds are a little like the outperformance is so subtle versus having SpaceX. Is the other thing that is interesting about this is how much will this kill the golden goose of the mark to magic NAVs? So if you have a private fund, a private stock in an ETF, you're going to have to mark it. So this is going to bring a whole lot of liquidity, I think, and more accurate pricing, which I think you're going to see the veil lifted off of the private equity, and the Wizard of Oz is sitting there and it's like, oh, it really is just like a stock. Like they're
the end of volatility laundering.
SpaceX isn't going to move like Tesla. Like what person thinks SpaceX is like has a money market type return stream? Yeah. It doesn't. So the ETFs are actually going to be, they could cause a little havoc in the private equity world itself due to the sort of lack of volatility that isn't real.
But by, you know, by all accounts, it's a much easier way to attract capital.
Exactly. And yeah. That's how much of the capital that's gone into privates is just because it doesn't move a lot. I don't know. But this need to democratize private equity from Blackstone and Apollo, and now the team up with Vanguard and State Street, be careful what you wish for. I mean, to me, this, they think they're the fox in the hen house. I think Vanguard and the ETFs are the fox in their hen house.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It just speaks to that, you know, that bias towards liquidity over patient capital, you know, like everybody wants to, I want to be able to get it now. I want to be able to sell it now. I want to be able to get in and out of it whenever I like. It's not like if you have an interval fund, you have to wait. If you're in a private equity, a traditional private equity fund, you have to wait. Like all these, you know, the traditional vehicles, they don't offer the exits and the, you know,
I think that's part of it,
and quick entries.
But I think also the fee competition in the ETFs is really powerful. Like I think people like,
too,
they're like, well, if the ETFs get into it, they'll lower the fees and I'll get a better deal there. Because intervals are pretty pricey. They get the liquidity and they're like, I don't really care if it trades at a discount or premium. I trust the price on it. So I think also ETFs maybe benefit again over mutual funds. Mutual funds are 120 years old or whatever. ETFs have less time to have screwed up. So they kind of, you know, are able to, they don't have really have too many issues where investors feel burned, XIV maybe, but like largely speaking, people keep coming back. They get a good experience. That trust is a factor as well. I think so. But liquidity certainly is part of it.
But yeah, the brand names, the transparency, the liquidity, the the daily trading, all of, and the just, I think people pervasively think the fees are just lower.
Yeah.
The fees may be lower, but the spreads are where you have to
agreed. Yeah. Agreed.
Well, yeah. And this is, I think
that's the price.
The other thing that I don't know if people know this for sure, but I think they sense it. The ETF, by bringing in all these liquid market makers and hedge funds who can do arbitrage very easily, that arbitrage makes the price feel pretty fair. So I know when an ETF's at a discount, I'm like, wait a second. It's not like a closed-end fund where there's just no, you can't, some reason that's discount. Oh, I know. There's a tax in Vietnam. So VNM trades at a 2% discount because the tax, the ARB can only start at 2% because the tax is baked in there. So normally the bullshit that you have to go through to get that exposure is baked into the percent premium or discount. The spreads are still a penny probably. It's the percent premium discount to me is where some of that price is baked in. But I've never found it to be like a ripoff beyond the baked in. It might be like 10 bips for the arbitrager, but it's usually like feels reasonable. It's never like 10% when it should be like 2. Or a closed-end fund where you're just sort of guessing what the price should be.
Right.
So I think those market makers are underappreciated aspect of the ETF world. They're behind the scenes. I'm not sure people even know they're there, but that AP market maker relationship and all the arbitrage is really good at keeping the price around where it should be.
Have you noticed though, with the proliferation of all these sort of smaller ETFs, some of that, some of that, are there enough market makers around to pay attention to everything?
That's like, a good point. So
I would say that that's something that we've noticed.
Yeah.
Is over the last year and in particular the last few weeks, is that bid ask spread has been getting awfully wide for no reason.
Yeah. The wider spreads especially for new ETFs is something to watch. We had ETF launch recently with no lead market maker. It was the cat bonds ETF, the catastrophe bonds. Yeah. That was interesting. I was like, wow. But you're right. I think watching the spreads, we should look into that. I'll riff off of that, because I think people go in expecting, if it's a liquid area, they want one basis point or two or three.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll tolerate more. But I want to know if the average in categories is widening. So apples to apples, if it is, then you're right. That would be an issue of the proliferation. That said, if it's a brand new ETF that holds some weird stuff and it's got a widespread,
I can accept that. Just think that this is something that we've been actually talking with a few people about. Some of it's been our experience, and some of these funds that we have are, a couple hundred million dollars. So they're not small and they're not really trading esoteric stuff.
Yeah.
So it is, it's when things are normal and everything's super calm, maybe everybody's got time to get to everything. As soon as you get some volatility, even post the volatility, it's something that's been coming up in conversation. So love to see what you guys come up with and looking into it and see if it's just an anecdotal experience that we're having or if it's more pervasive.
Yeah. Good question.
Anyway, something to talk about later.
Good chat,
Eric,
guys.
Eric, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time. It's been great having you.
See you guys next time.
Look forward to that.